Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I am your host, Ken Molman. This is the My View Matters radio network. And assuming the music stays turned down this week, which it has not had a history of doing for the last 2 weeks, we'll get right to it here. We've got a lot on the agenda tonight, so if you'd like to call in about any of the topics, you can do so by calling area code 858-683-1326. Again, 858-683-1326. And, boy, what do we have on the list tonight? Starting out with some Libertarian Party news, a couple of just quick things. There's a new news agency that's out specifically to report on the Libertarian Party, created in response to the fact that the Libertarian Party, despite being America's third largest party and out doing stuff regularly, receives relatively little ink, and as such, this organization has been launched to try to keep track of what's going around the country and in different places around the country with the Libertarian Party. And speaking of that type of news, the Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania lost a lawsuit or was thrown out of court. And it's kind of a long story, but the very short version of it is that the Libertarian Party was challenged in Pennsylvania. Their petition signatures to get Gary Johnson on the ballot was challenged. Now, this is a pretty typical tactic. In Pennsylvania, the way ballot access works there is that you have to collect a large number of signatures, and they have a loser pays policy there. So if there's a challenge and you lose, you can be liable for the costs of the challenging party or the challenged party, whoever loses, can be liable for the costs of both organizations for the challenge. And so this is usually used as a tool to scare away competition. I believe in 2008, the Libertarian Party chose not to try to survive the challenge and instead bowed out despite having collected more than enough signatures. And this year, in 2012, they refused to bow out. The process took 7 weeks to accomplish. The Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania sued for over $200,000 in fees and costs associated with that. And unfortunately, the judge says that it was filed too late and that it's thrown out. And I've seen some other things here that say that it was shenanigans that did this, that there is a precedent for giving 30 days to file the case against it, the lawsuit. It's just whatever, and it's typical. You know, if the Republicans or Democrats had done the same, I'm sure it would have survived, but that's just the way it goes. When you're a third party, you have to play ultra strict by the rules and expect to get the short end of the stick on a consistent basis. So anyway, getting to some of the issues here in Kentucky. Industrial hemp, Senate Bill 50, it was passed out of the House, or excuse me, passed out of the Senate pretty quickly, hit the House, got stuck in the Agriculture Committee for my representative, Tom McKee, Stonewalder, for a week, and dragged the clock out on it. And after he did finally let it out of committee, it hit the House floor. And at that point, Stumbo, the House leader, declared it dead. I don't think he actually declared it dead, but it was declared dead, and that Stumbo was not going to allow it to come up. And then sometime in the past week or so, there was an amendment filed that's supposedly going to make it so that the House would allow it. And that amendment does several key things and differently than what Senate Bill 50 was originally designed to do. Probably the most important things, number one, it takes the Hemp Commission out of the Department of Agriculture, the Agriculture Commission, which is where it exists today. There is a commission today under the Department of Agriculture, and it would instead put that commission into the hands of the University of Kentucky and the Kentucky State Police. Now, understand that the State Police were the number one people testifying against the creation of this framework that if the feds were to legalize the production of industrial hemp, would have put Kentucky ready to go to start immediately upon that passage at the federal level. And that's what this law does. It doesn't nullify anything. It's nothing like that. It just sets up a framework that if the feds do decide to legalize industrial hemp, that they will be able to jump on it right away. That's all this does. There was some criticism saying it wasn't right, all that kind of jazz. Now, I personally think that's kind of bogus, because I'm pretty sure that the industrial hemp issue at the federal level is still a few years out. But and so, you know, in future sessions, they could have tweaked it however they wanted to. But to give it to the state police is kind of an interesting move, since the state police were the people that were primarily against the whole measure to begin with and testified. So their people couldn't tell the difference between industrial hemp and marijuana, which is silly, but whatever, and a lot of other things related to that. Additionally, one of the key concerns is if you put the permitting process under the state police, then much like the concealed carry issue, those that are familiar with that, there were different states that had the may issue versus the shall issue for permits, and there's nothing that creates a shall issue situation here. So if you give it to the state police, who are against industrial hemp, the feds make it legal, it comes back to the state. Well, if the police have it and they're against it, then they just won't issue any permits. And so I don't think that's really a workable solution. There was also a change in the way the testing was going to be done. The Department of Agriculture says they can do the tests for about $5 a piece to test for THC levels, which is the intoxicant in marijuana. And the other group wants to do a $700 per test on this. And as far as I can tell, there's no limit per se on how many tests they would want to run per farm. It would also create a registry of industrial hemp processors, which I don't really understand what that's about, but whatever. I don't know why the processors have anything to worry about anyway. They're just processing the stalks, and there's nothing good out of that except for industrial purposes, no matter what plant it is. And we're kind of waiting. Apparently the Kentucky Hemp Commission is expected later this week to jump in on this and give their official response to what's going on. But on the grassroots level, there's definitely a lot of people upset about this move. There's a lot of people that really think that this is more of a partisan thing. The police side, they're apparently worried that they're going to lose $1 million a year in federal grant money that they get to fight marijuana in the state. And that seems to be their concern, is that they might be cut out of the grant money. And so it's kind of a mess, and it's kind of sad that, you know, a bill that all it does is puts a framework in place for if the feds make industrial hemp legal again, is being stonewalled in the House. And it's unfortunate, because I think it was 3 years ago, we've been over this on the show, but I think it was 3 years ago, Democrats had a very similar bill that they pushed and that Republicans blocked 3 years ago. So a lot of this, I think, has to do with just partisan wrangling, where, you know, if the Republicans propose it, Democrats are against it. If Democrats propose it, Republicans are against it. It's just a shame. We need to cut through all that stuff and do something good for the state. And speaking of cutting through all that stuff, one of the other interesting things that came out this week was an article about a company called Wildcat Moving. Apparently, Kentucky has a law that if you want to be a moving company in the state of Kentucky, you have to basically ask all of the other moving companies in the area for permission to open a moving company. Now, I hope everybody sees the issue with that, that, you know, if you had to ask every restaurant in an area if you could open a restaurant, or if you wanted to ask every, you know, whatever business, right? If you're coming in as a competitor, the natural instinct, of course, of any business person is, no, I'd rather not have a competitor. And so it's a very strange, strange situation. It was reported on in redstate.com. And it's really strange. So Senate Bill 132 was apparently proposed to try to fix this problem, but it got stuck in the House Transportation Committee, and apparently it's been declared dead. So unfortunately, that will continue, apparently. I would hope that somebody would fire up a lawsuit on that or something. There's absolutely no logical reason why you would need to ask competitors or potential competitors if you are allowed to set up shop. I mean, that, of course they're going to say no. That's going to stifle any new business. It's going to stifle competition, which in the end hurts consumers because it's fewer options to go out and search for a company that does the job that you want to do. So that's really unfortunate, and we'll keep following that issue. There are a number of other places where those types of situations exist, especially in healthcare in the state, and that's just, again, not good for consumers. Competition helps deliver better products at better prices, and when you take away competition, you create monopolies, you create oligopolies. It is not good for consumers. The quality will go down and the prices will go up when protectionism is in place. Saw an interesting article about kind of switching gears here. Due process, and we've talked about due process quite a bit on the show. Due process, for those that aren't quite familiar, the idea that there's a process that when you are charged with a crime, you know, you have a judge, you have a jury, and the different aspects of criminal justice, starting from apprehending a suspect, to going to court, to a jury, to being declared guilty or not guilty, and if declared guilty, the sentencing therein. So there is a process there. It's called due process. It's there to prevent any one person from arbitrarily deciding that someone has violated the law and locking them up. But it's exactly what happened here, and this was not in Kentucky. But a gentleman named Stephen Slevin was arrested on a drunk driving charge in 2005, and was also part of that was a charge of stealing a vehicle. He spent 22 months in solitary confinement, but he never went to trial. He was never taken in front of a judge and jury for the alleged crime. 22 months he spent in solitary confinement. And now he has sued the county that did this to him and won. A jury awarded him $22 million for these violation of his rights. The county appealed, but then settled at $15.5 million and dropped the appeal. So this gentleman, who unfortunately had to spend 22 months in solitary confinement, will now get money, and $15.5 million is a good bit of money. But I don't know if I'd want to trade 22 years in solitary confinement for $15 million. That's not a good way to live. The guy apparently now is suffering from PTSD. He had to pull his own teeth. He had dental issues, and they wouldn't let him see a dentist. So he had to pull his own teeth. He looks horrible in the pictures. And I'm glad that this story is out there, because it needs to be out there to reinforce that due process is not just a good idea, it's the law, and it's the law for a very good reason, going all the way back to our founding when the King of England and his minions were, just incarcerating people ad hoc, and there was nothing that the colonists could do. It's important to have the ability to face a jury of your peers, to have due process to protect your rights. And so that is another good story that's out there, and I've actually heard from one jailer already who said he was going to share this story with his people at his jail. So I'm very happy to hear that this story is, by getting out there, having a positive effect on the process, and that's great. It's unfortunate this guy had to suffer, But it is what it is, and so we look at the positive side of it. So if you have any contacts with your county jailer, I'd recommend sharing that story with them as well. If you do a Google search for Stephen Slevin, that's Stephen with a V, and drunk driving, you should be able to find him that way. Let's see here. We've got quite a nanny state update this week, and it's pretty lengthy here. Look at my time. Yeah, we'll do this, and then we'll hit the break. So there's a lot going on with nanny state stuff. there's an article that came out today, actually, about sooner or later the progressives will get around to you, and what he really means is the nanny staters. They start talking about how, you know, we've started with the tobacco and the smoking bans, but it's really more than that, and that's I try to tell people this all the time, that these smoking bans have greater ramifications than just the smoking ban. When you start justifying things based on medical costs, it doesn't stop. And that's how, for instance, the soda ban in New York, which thankfully was overturned by a judge here very recently, but the soda size ban happened in New York. Now, I suspect that if they had banned soda outright, that it may have stood, but the idea that you can't buy more than, 16 ounces at a time, is kind of stupid because you can just buy two. And so I think that's, based on what I saw, that seemed to be the premise of why they threw it out. The size of it was kind of stupid, the size aspect to it. But you have salt bans and trans fat bans and soda taxes in other areas. And Bloomberg's attempt to limit the sizes of soft drinks you can buy. We have all these examples of where when you start talking about health costs justifying taking away options from consumers, that you start losing all of these things. And it's a really dangerous thing. I try to explain to folks, you know, and it's hard to explain because, you know, smoking is not good for you. And people know that, and I think everybody agrees that it's not good for you. But it's not about what's good or bad for you that should be at issue here. It's about individual choices and individual responsibility for those choices. And when you come from the framework of protecting people from their own individual choices, that's a really scary thing. Think about that. Protecting society as a whole protects people from their own individual choices. Now, there are things that everyone does that's probably a minority behavior of some sort. Minority behavior being that the majority of the population does not do it because we're all individuals. We all have things that we like to do that others don't like, and that's okay, right? I mean, I got a quote up here from Piers Morgan on the soda ban and what he had to say about it. And he said, quote, "I think people need the nanny state occasionally, particularly on issues like smoking, drinking and guzzling sodas that are too big for them, eating 16 Big Macs a day. Whatever it may be, the reality is we all need a little bit of nannying about us." That's the attitude that gets us in a really dangerous place because, again, we all engage in minority behaviors. We all do things that others don't do. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. It makes us individuals. And there are choices that I make that I know others think are dumb. And there are choices that other people make that I think are stupid. But that's okay. As long as you're not forcing me to participate in those activities, no problem. All right? I mean, as long as people are leaving each other alone, who really cares? I mean, if you're not hurting anybody else, then who cares? And I guess that's the frustrating part of all of this is that so many people on the smoking ban side especially see it as, well, man, it's smoking. It's not good for you. I mean, it's bad, you know, and, oh, we just, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, there's not a smokers left out there anymore. And that's true. But it doesn't stop at smoking. It never will stop at smoking. The places that were the early adopters of smoking bans moved on from there. They're the ones who have implemented the salt bans and the soda bans and the soda taxes and the all these different bans and taxes and ways to try to regulate individual behavior for the good of society to protect people from their own individual decisions. I just saw a really interesting study that came out that talks about how if you don't get enough sleep at night, it can actually cause bad or negative genetic effects on your body. There's a study out of UK that shows that if you get less than 6 hours of sleep per night, for a consecutive week, which, by the way, that's me. I've had plenty of weeks where I've had less than 6 hours a night, that it can cause negative gene expression in human blood cells, reduces the amplitude of circadian rhythms in gene expression, and intensifies the effects of subsequent acute total loss on gene expression. That's a lot of fancy wording. What it basically means is that when you are not sleeping properly, your body is not doing the proper maintenance on itself. And if you don't get enough sleep, it affects things like your metabolic rate. It affects things like your body's ability to heal itself. And in fact, it suggests that perhaps a lack of sleep may cause an increased risk of cancer. And do we really now want to open the door with this new study? And that's how they always – it's funny. All these things always get framed against smoking. There was another one I saw a few months ago about how sitting in an office for 8 hours a day is less healthy than smoking. Everything always comes back to compare it against smoking because everybody's got these smoking bans everywhere else in the U.S., and that's what you'll always hear here. Oh, my gosh, there's smoking bans everywhere else. Why not here? It all comes back to the smoking issue, and then they could use it as comparative. Well, this is more dangerous than smoking. You know, you need to be up and moving around. You can't sit at a desk for 8 hours a day in a cube and do your job. You got to do something, you know, move around, whatever. You got to get proper sleep, you know, whatever. Well, how far are we willing to take that? I mean, I appreciate the information. I think it's good to have information. To be informed is a good thing. To be informed means we can make better decisions as individuals. The problem is it never stops there. The government decides, hey, I'm going to jump in, and I'm here to help. And I'm going to tell you that you need to get this sleeping regimen, you need this food regimen, right? This is your nutrition regimen. And no smoking. Depending on who you talk to, either one glass of alcohol or none per day or per week or whatever. No, we got to get rid of the salt. We got to get rid of the trans fat. We got to get rid of this. We got to get rid of that. We're going to keep you from doing this. You got to do this. Where does it stop? It never stops. And with Obamacare now actively telling people that they must do certain things, and in this case, it's a tax, so it doesn't go that far. But that's the direction we're heading, right? Now government's the Obamacare decision allows government to dictate to you what you must do rather than penalizing you for things that you've done. We're moving in a very scary direction where government is going to be telling us what we can and can't do. Government's going to be telling us how to run our lives. And I've heard from people in the medical field that that's actually a big part of Obamacare, that part of this is going to be that they're going to figure out a regimen that is quasi-tailored to your specific physiology and that there will be penalties if you fail to follow them. In other words, they're going to penalize people for making individual choices that are considered unhealthy. And this is dangerous. I mean, folks, make no mistake. I mean, there's lots of activities that people don't have to do. I like to go whitewater rafting. Used to go a lot. Haven't been lately, but I love it. It's a lot of fun. But it's also dangerous. People die every year. Are you going to ban it? I mean, we don't have to do it. There's other ways to get exercise. There's other ways to be outdoors. We don't have to go whitewater rafting. And that's the danger behind all this. I choose to go whitewater rafting. I think it's fun. I like to do it. It's my decision. I know that it's dangerous. I know that people die. But it's what I choose to do. That's an individual decision. And a fully informed one at that. If we take away individual decisions, then we become nothing more than robots, cogs in a machine. The Republican side of this always likes to talk about how we make people more effective workers, how much productivity we have, how we can be so much more productive if we're healthy. I'm sorry, I didn't realize that my job, my duty in life was to be productive, to be a cog in the machine. Nobody told me that. But apparently, according to those on the Republican side that push for this stuff, that's their reasoning. The state chamber of commerce, you look at why they want a smoking ban. Why? Because it makes healthy employees more healthy and therefore more productive. Oh, wait a second, man. That's not your job to make me more or less productive. That's between me and my boss. And if my boss doesn't like my work, he can dock me or fire me. That's the relationship there. That's employer-employee relationship. We don't need the government getting involved in that situation, too. At the end of the day, we as individuals must make individual decisions. I like having this kind of information, the lack of sleep, what it does. I like the information about, you know, all these different things. I mean, I've done so much research on the smoking ban issue because of my involvement in fighting it. There's all kinds of interesting science behind it all. Very good science. Science that's done right. That's very, very interesting. Ever wonder why it is that you know people that only smoke when they drink? Because of the way that nicotine and alcohol interact with each other as chemicals in the brain. It's amazing stuff. It's really cool science to understand brain physiology and receptors and how it all works. It's very cool. But at the end of the day, I don't want the government making decisions for me. No one knows me better than me, and no one knows you better than you. And that's the crux of it. We don't need a nanny state. We don't want a nanny state. And even if you think you want a nanny state, trust me, you don't. Because there is something you do individually that is a minority behavior. And if you let the state dictate what is and is not okay, what you will find is that minority behaviors will become outlawed. Because the majority says, oh, you don't need to be doing that. Everything we do involves risk. Every single action we take involves risk. So if we're going to minimize risk, then we have to ban behavior. But you can't ban popular behavior. You can only ban minority behavior. So every single – what the end of this is we're going to end up with government dictating that every single minority behavior – is illegal or is penalized in some way. That's where this train leads. That's where we're heading. So when people say, why are you fighting the smoking ban? Smoking's bad for you. It's a losing issue. All this stuff that I get heard or that I hear, that I get told, that's the reason I fight against it. At the end of the day, I can smoke in other places. I don't have to. I'm a smoker. I think everybody knows that. But I can go elsewhere. I don't need the restaurants and the bars and that. I don't have to go out as an individual. But look where else this goes. Look further down the road. Don't put the blinders on and just go, I hate smoking, so I'm for a smoking ban. Understand what you're enabling with that stuff. Nannies cannot help themselves. They cannot stop micromanaging. That's what they are. They are micromanagers. It's in their nature to do it. If you give them an inch, they will try to take a mile. And when you empower them to take that inch, it becomes very difficult to stop them from going further. With that in mind, we're here at the bottom of the hour. So we're going to take a break here real fast when we get back. Boy, a number of topics I'm going to have to hit here in pretty quick. But we've got CPAC. We've got GOP backtracking excuses, and we've got the ag gag bills, and Obama rolling out the use of some Nixon-era laws for environmental stuff. So Hang tight, folks. We've got a lot left to cover. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springsteen of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
Whoops. All right. So I should mention, if you want to call into the show, again, the number here is area code 858-683-1255. 1-326, 858-683-1326 to talk about this or any of the other topics that we're about to cover in the next half hour. So the big news, of course, this week in the political world was CPAC. Quite a bit of that going on, a lot of different things coming out of that. Probably the number one thing that I saw was the Rand Paul speech. I listened to it. I thought it was very good. I think that if the GOP were to listen to his advice that he gave in his speech, that they would actually have a legitimate chance of revitalizing their party. I think they'd have a legitimate chance of gaining new, younger voters, talking about dropping some of the social issues that are really big government issues anyway, trying to regulate people's personal behavior. Those are not good ideas in general, and more people rejecting those. So it's a really good idea, what he had out there. But the big question is, will it be heeded by the GOP? I have to say, I don't think so. George Will was on, what was that, Face the Nation, I think it was. This Week with David Brinkley. And he said that he has a quote here. Republicans have been arguing, social conservatives and libertarian free market conservatives, since the 1950s. It has worked. The coalition, the fusion of the two, has worked before with Ronald Reagan. It can work again. What I did see at the CPAC conference was a rise of libertarian strand of republicanism, which has affected foreign policy, that is a pullback from nation building and other ambitions abroad that they never. Anyway, the point is, whatever, that we're just going to ignore that story because he likes to talk in big words that don't really say anything. The point is that the Republican Party is trying to move towards a libertarian perspective. And, of course, it's a right-leaning libertarianism. But I don't see the shift as a legitimate shift in the Republican Party. There were a number of folks that came out and talked about decriminalizing certain drugs and talking about the gay marriage issue and talking about stopping the regulation of, gay marriage. I guess my frustration with this whole story is that this isn't the first time this has tried to happen. Will mentions 1980. As one of the times that the libertarians and the other factions of the Republican Party have worked together successfully. And in fact, it's actually, that was the second time that that had occurred. In 1964, the Goldwater Republicans were a mix of the Liberty activists and some of the paleoconservatives working to push forward for at least a partial liberty agenda. And 1980 obviously was Reagan, and then in 1994 as well, there were a lot of libertarian themes in the Contract with America. And, of course, now we have today where the Republican Party is trying to make this shift, or there's a push to shift the Republican Party towards the liberty activists or the liberty position. The problem that I see is that this is a cycle, and you can look at the dates and you can see it's every 14 to 16 years this comes around. There's a cycle, and what happens is the Republican establishment does things that make them lose credibility. It does things that are generally unpopular, and they lose all their political capital. They're decimated. You know, they lose major elections. They get decimated. And at that point, the Liberty people all come storming in, oh, we're going to take over, and they start trying to take over the Republican Party, and in some limited way are successful at doing so. And they start rebuilding the Republican Party's credibility by doing that. They come in, they start talking about things that are very popular. Liberty is popular. And so they start talking about those things that are very popular. You know, we talked last week about Rand Paul's filibuster over the drone issue. That's one that's very, very popular People do not want domestic drones with the ability to shoot first and ask questions later, depriving people of due process, flying in American skies. I mean, that's a very popular issue. So they rebuild that credibility. Once the credibility is built back up, the political capital is there, the establishment swoops in, kicks out all the liberty people, and then implements the very same policies that destroyed them in the first place, those very same anti-liberty policies in direct conflict with what the liberty activists were trying to do. And then they destroy their credibility again, and they lose all their political capital, and the process starts over again. And I have to ask the question, what's changed? What's different this time? And no one has been able to give me that answer. No one's been able to say, oh, well, this time it's going to work because XYZ is happening instead. What is XYZ this time? What is it that is so different this time? I don't see it. And it's funny because a number of the people making this push don't know this history. They don't realize 64, 80, 94. It's the same thing. And, of course, there's more to libertarianism than the liberty right, which I know people get confused. The liberty right gets a lot of media. But there's also a liberty left, and there's also the straight up and down libertarianism. And there's different aspects and angles to this. So if you're thinking, well, I don't like that stuff that happened in 80 and 94 either, it's okay. I mean, understand there's different aspects, and if you have a consistent principle in liberty, it all makes sense. We don't have enough time to go into all that tonight. But the point being that this is a cycle. It's happened over and over and over, and now we're here again. What's different? Personally, I've decided that I will not work to build political capital for who will become my political enemies. That's why I do my thing in the Libertarian Party, not in the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. I don't hold it against anybody that thinks that crashing one of those parties is the way to go. I understand why. I understand the political realities of why. There are a lot of people who don't even pay attention to who's actually on the ballot that walk in, press straight party ticket, hit vote, and walk out. And you can capture a lot of their vote, because they have no clue what's going on if you can get through the primary process of the major parties. I understand why you're doing that. But I personally see that what ends up inevitably happening is that ends up building political capital for the people who then turn around and use that political capital against us. Within the Republican Party at CPAC this year, the Santorum faction was still there. And that's the social conservative over everything else faction. There was a story I saw a few days ago, and I couldn't find it again before the show. I looked for a couple hours, and I could not find it. But it was a story about how some of the social conservative groups were pushing for a new bit of spending that totaled $80 billion. You know, this is spending that's not happening today that would be new. Well, that means that the measly sequester cuts, which I believe were about $85 billion, are basically eaten up by one new program pushed from the right. These are the same people who claim to be Republicans and in line with the platform. And that's who you're fighting inside the Republican Party. You know, likewise, you have Democrats that push for civil rights, or they claim to, but they don't make any real effort to get that moving, whether because it's politically unpopular or because they don't really care, whatever the reason is. The reality is that the best way to affect politics is to vote for individuals. Don't vote parties. You know, and I say that, guys, I'm the chairman of the Libertarian Party of Kentucky at this point. And I mentioned that a couple of shows ago. I mean, that's what I am now. But I want you to look at candidates and decide who is the best candidate, who reflects my values the best. And the more people we get to do that, the more people we get to quit using the easy button, we take away some of that power from the party machinery. Because that's what a lot of this is the party machinery making sure that they have a hammer lock on the political process. That's what drives this goal of taking over one of the major parties. If you take away the hammer lock, then trying to take over somebody else's party becomes a non-issue. But while you're trying to take over the parties now, while it still is an issue, all you're doing really is actually increasing and reinforcing their hammer lock on the process. That's not helping things, in my opinion. And I'm not trying to fault anybody who's going that direction. My opinion is that you're helping them perpetuate the status quo, perpetuate the problem. That's why I don't do it. I'd love to hear somebody tell me why this time it's different from 1964, 1980, and 94. What's different this time? And no one has been able to tell me that. So since we're on the topic of the Republican Party anyway, I found some interesting stuff came out here on the wire today, actually, about a number of different things. Republican Rince Priebus says that the GOP's problem with 2012, why they lost in 2012, had nothing to do with the fact that Mitt Romney was a horrible candidate and that he didn't inspire anybody, but it was a branding problem and a ridiculous number of debates. And he suggests scaling back the number of debates and debate participants. He suggests a branding process, which I don't think they really have that issue. I think everyone's keenly aware of what the Republican establishment brand is. I think that's their problem, is that nobody likes what they're selling. But he wants to cut it down to 7 or 8 debates, cut down the number of people in the debates. And I think that's actually going to hurt them as well. Because when you're running, maybe not next time, because next time it's going to be an open race, but when you're running against an incumbent, you have to build name ID and you have to build recognition of what it is that you're going to do. And so this may sound funny, but I'm actually quite serious when I put this out there, that if the Republicans were smart, they'd actually run their debates a lot like American Idol, where you start out with everybody who's in the race, and I mean everybody who's declared and filed paperwork, some very low threshold, and then you start kicking people out based on the responses, right? And in the polls, you have to include everybody, not just 4 or 5 names, but everybody, and you talk, you know, even ask the question, of all those that you saw, who did you not like the most? Right, and start filtering them out that way. And I actually think that process may work. That if you ran it a lot more like American Idol and a whole lot less like a controlled thing where only a certain number of people are even invited, a subset, and you control it in a way that it gets the message out there and how these guys really differ from one another, you can come to a better candidate, somebody who stands for something that actually energizes the base. Mitt Romney didn't energize anybody to do anything. The only energy from the Republican Party this time, in 12, was they didn't like Obama. That was their rally cry. We don't like Obama. Well, that's not a positive message. That's not going to convince the middle to vote for your guy. So that's a big problem. And part of that is you got to be consistent and you have to be principled. And speaking of that, there's 2 stories this week, entertainingly, about John Boehner and Paul Ryan both talking about the deficit. Now, Paul Ryan, as everyone should know, is the guy that keeps putting out these budgets that are supposed to balance the budget over the course of 25 years or something like that. And Boehner, of course, is the Speaker of the House, Speaker of the House. And both are now saying that debt is not an immediate problem. Well, I don't know when debt becomes an immediate problem because, you know, we have more debt than our annual GDP. So we owe more than we bring in as a country or that we create as a country every year. So what do we do? Is that not an emergency? I think it is. You know, if I make $20,000 a year and I owe $25,000, that's pretty bad. The chances of digging out of that hole are pretty much slim and none. And by being inconsistent on this issue, they do themselves a lot of harm. They do themselves the harm of people don't believe them that they're serious anymore, and it actually harms the issue itself. And it is an issue. Debt, our debt is an issue. Our national debt, our unfunded liabilities, these are all very important issues that need to be addressed. And we need to be doing it in a way that is not partisan. We need to be doing it in a way that is looking at answers, solutions. We need to figure out what our priorities are in this country. Are we more interested in building bridges in Iraq and Afghanistan and trying to get those governments stabilized? Are we more interested in staying there for a decade in the Middle East? Or are we more interested in building our infrastructure here? I think that's a no-brainer. I'm pretty sure most people would agree that we need to be focused on us first. Our government should be focused on us first and anything else second, right? I mean, that's a pretty easy priority line to draw. Yet we spend an enormous amount of money on foreign military affairs. We cannot afford to be the policemen of the world. Not only is there not really a moral purpose to doing so, although that can be argued, I don't see one. It's not our responsibility to protect other people. It's their responsibility to protect themselves. But we don't have the money to do it. And that's a big part of this, a real big part. I notice I only have a few minutes left, so I need to get to a couple of things here real quick. There's a new type of bill that's come out called an ag-gag bill, or that's the term that's being used. What these are, they are bills that make it illegal to take pictures inside of a mega farm. And to make it, there's actually one here specifically in Florida that was proposed that would have made it a felony to take photography at or of a farm. A first-degree felony. I mean, first-degree felonies are typically your manslaughters, those are really big crimes. And there's also bills like it in Minnesota and Iowa, and they're called ag gag bills, agriculture gags, so you can't see what's going on. I think that's a bad, bad precedent. I think it's important, and we've talked about this show on the show many times. I'm not against the mega farms. The mega farms want to exist, that's awesome. Whatever. If you want to buy food from a mega farm, awesome, whatever. But I think labeling food or knowing where your food comes from as a more general concept is an important thing as a consumer. It helps us make better decisions as consumers. I can choose to go down the street to a farmer's market. Well, not down the street for me, but metaphorically speaking, I can go to a farmer's market or I can go to the supermarket. That's my decision to make. And as an individual consumer, I can find out, you know, pretty quickly if I go to a farm, especially a small farm, and see how the conditions are, whether or not I want to buy food from that local farmer. I can't do that. And if they're making it illegal to take pictures of these things, I definitely will not be allowed to find, I won't, and that's the key thing, won't be allowed to find out what the mega farms are doing. And that's a big problem for me. I don't think that's a very good way to go in the long term. I think it's important for consumers to be able to find out how their food, or I'm sorry, how the food that they're looking to purchase came about. It makes better consumers of us if we are educated consumers. Again, leaving the choice to individuals on whether or not to buy it, but giving us the information so that we can make that decision. And part of that information is knowing how these things work, how the mega farms are, what is it, you know, that they're doing at these things in particular. I have a real big problem with government interfering with this. We talked, boy, it's been months ago now, about the push at the world level. The World Trade Organization is trying to take away the product of, you know, insert country name here stickers that we have in America. There's a law that requires that when food is imported from another country, it has product of whatever that country is. Now, apparently that violates some sort of treaty, you know, worldwide from the WTO, World Trade Organization. Why is that good for consumers to take away information? That's not a good thing. I like to know where my food came from, because then I, as a consumer, can go, you know, I'm not real hip to buying food from that country over there, but I'm okay with this country here. It makes us more informed as consumers. That's a good thing, because informed consumers are better consumers. Better consumers drive a better free market, and a better free market means that we get higher quality goods, and that's the big part of information, leads to quality, at better prices, because the competition aspect itself drives the prices. Information is power. We should never, ever be limited in the information that we can obtain on the food that we want to buy. Wrap up the show here. We've got the Nixon-era law being used by the Obama administration to crack down on environmental issues. And essentially what's happening here is the Clean Air Act is being used by regulators to expand the purview of the EPA. So the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts were passed during the Nixon administration. They were signed by Nixon. Nixon actually created the EPA as an administrative body to enforce the aspects of the Clean Air and Clean Water Act. The problem here is that things like cap and trade, which have been shot down legislatively, are now coming back around through the regulatory agencies. Not unlike, by the way, the smoking ban issue, where here in the state they get shot down legislatively, and now the regulatory bodies are sneaking around the back door to put them in anyway. You have to be aware that Republicans, Democrats, the folks, if you're on one side or the other, whatever, you have to know that everything that one side does, just because it's your team, isn't good. You have to be able to call things out when they're bad. And just because a Republican did it and you're a Republican, you should not defend that policy. Just because a Democrat did it and you're a Democrat, you should not defend that policy. The energy prices are going to skyrocket. There is no plan involved in all of this. There's nothing that says, hey, let's fix this. And holy cow, we're out of time. We're going to go a minute over. There's nothing that says, you know, I guess the point is this. We need to be aware. We have to be able to, so nonpartisan, that we're able to call people out when they do things that are wrong. We have to put party allegiances aside and say, that's wrong. I'm calling you out. The anti-war left, where'd you guys go? You're gone. Where'd you go? Republicans, when there's a new program, new spending, and it's by the Republicans, you have to call it out. You can't just say, well, it's Republicans, so we'll just keep quiet about it. No. That's exactly the problem. And with that, folks, I'm going to wrap it up here because we're already a minute over. I want to thank everybody for tuning in this week. You know, I hope next week you'll tune back in. Tell your friends, tell your family. We're here every week, Sunday night at 7. Also listen to the other shows on the network, Monday through Thursday, 7 o'clock Eastern Time. Until next time, I'm your host, Ken Molman. Thanks for tuning in. It's been another edition of Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network.